Hi, I'm Paul Lisnick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain.
This is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of people, too. People who smile at you.
And yes, Chicago is our kind of town, isn't it? Whether you live here in Chicago, listening from home ground, or whether you're listening from anywhere else, Chicago is everybody's favorite town. And this is Paul Lisnick. Welcome to Behind the Curtain. Today, we're going to focus in on a new book. In fact, the whole podcast will be dedicated to this conversation today, unusual for me, but I thought it was well worth it, because the book is called The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities. The co-authors are Ed Bachrach and Austin Berg. They are joining me now. You may have seen them appear on my television show, Politics Tonight, but here we have the comfort of the podcast world, where we're not worried about taking commercial breaks. We can just chat. The book, The New Chicago Way, is published by Southern Illinois University Press in Carbondale. And boy, guys, welcome. You have gotten so much buzz from this book. As everybody, you become these sort of experts that every talk show wants to have on because of the issues you raise. So I'll start by saying welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Thanks for having us.
All right. So, Ed, let me start with you. One of the things that brought you to everybody's attention, of course, in Chicago, just coming off of a mayoral election, and a lot of people do sit back and say, why the heck do we have this mayoral and aldermanic election in February on an off year when the weather's terrible, nobody wants to go to the polls? What's the deal? Ed, why is it that way? And is it just it's always been that way?
Well, there is a long history behind it, but the essence of it is that it is incumbent protection program. It is designed and has been designed for decades to give the incumbent the advantage. And we could go back in history and I could explain it. But what's more important?
Well, you know what? Go ahead. I wouldn't mind a little bit of that history, because I mean, I think everything that we look at today that we wonder, like, is that the way it should be? I always feel like it goes back to Richard J. Daley days. But you know, maybe sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't.
Well, it goes back even before then. It's a statewide law for city municipal elections, and it arose back at a time when they inaugurated municipal officers in May, so they had to have a primary and a general election before May, and then they were at one time partisan, and they became nonpartisan. So that's really the history, the summary of the history. But what's more important is that other big cities, and that's what our book is based upon, the top 15 cities in the United States, have all gone away from that. They've gone to having their elections in November, and there's much academic literature that says that timing drives turnout. So it's time for Chicago to catch up to other big cities,
yeah,
so that you don't have to go out in the middle of the winter and vote.
And Austin, I think one of the reasons people I have been so intrigued, certainly in you know, my field, people that watch politics and all of that, is because every point you make, every discussion you have, pensions, I mean, this is more about than just the elections in this book, but it is about looking at all of these other major cities. So I'm sort of curious as to what triggered this. Did you guys, you know, wake up one day and just go, you know, Chicago's got some real issues here, let's check some other cities? Or were you, Austin, already aware that we were out of step with other cities and wanted to put it in writing?
That's a really interesting question. Yeah, I mean, the elections issue is the prime example, right? We can debate all day about what the origin of the February cold election was, and it certainly, you know, would have had an effect on voter turnout this year on election day. You know, snowing, low of 11, I think, wind chill on election day this year.
Ooh, it sounds cozy.
It's chilly. People don't want to go out and vote. And you know, it's not just complaining about that. It's looking at the fact that we're such an outlier. Structurally, none of the top 15 cities have these elections in February. But yes, it goes much beyond that. And I think really, Ed can talk sort of about his inspiration for the book. But for me, in my other work, I looked especially at in 2016, I was engaged in an advocacy battle to legalize food carts in Chicago. Those, if you go to neighborhoods like Little Village or Pilsen, you'll see a lot of, it's usually women, older Latino women, selling things like tamales or sliced fruit. And those were illegal in Chicago for many decades, and primarily because of the influence of brick-and-mortar restaurants. And, you know, we thought that was wrong and fought for those entrepreneurs' rights to be able to do that, and we won. There is now a license in the city to license these street food cart vendors. But what happened after that? You had aldermen raising their hands and saying, not on this street, not on this block, not in front of this restaurant, not on this block, not on this block. And it became a patchwork, an unmanageable patchwork of regulations for these low-income entrepreneurs. And that really got me thinking, are other cities like this? Why in Chicago are aldermen entrusted with these feudal sort of administrative powers at a block-by-block, business-by-business, sidewalk-by-sidewalk level? Is that the case in other cities? And as we, you know, looked deeper and deeper into this book, we found that, you know, a lot of people in Chicago think that the strongman political power structure died with Richard J. Daley. But it lives on through our institutions, our governance institutions. That's really what we found by sort of picking our heads up and looking around.
You know, Ed, one of the, and what Austin just tapped into it, which is I think if you ask people, do we have a strong mayor and weak city council, they probably would say yes, but that's not supposed to be what it is. The structure is meant to be a weak mayor and a strong city council, but it really has not worked that way. And I've also found it interesting through the research of UIC professor Dick Simpson and his colleagues that, you know, most people have said, well, Mayor Daley, Mayor even Richard M. Daley, just ironclad control over city council, and yet it didn't take Rahm Emanuel but a year or so to get even stronger control over city council than Daley even had. What is it about this city designed for a strong city council that just lets the mayor do whatever he or she wants?
Yes. Well, there's a laundry list of specific features of city government that allow any mayor to aggrandize that power to himself or herself. So, and that's what the book is all about, and that is, what are the nuts and bolts of governance? What do they do in other cities, and what do we do here? But the laundry list in Chicago, let's start by the fact that the mayor presides over the city council. You go to a city council meeting, which incidentally is only once a month, and the mayor is there presiding. That doesn't happen in other cities where they have a strong council. They have a council president that presides, and the mayor is a true executive. Then in Chicago, the mayor fills vacancies that arise in the city council. So everybody does a resignation dance to get a favor of some kind from the mayor before they resign, generally to have a family relative take their seat. So those council people are beholden to the mayor. We have no term limits. The mayor gets involved in redistricting so he can punish people that run against him. So there are a whole litany of different features of our government that don't exist in other major cities, and that's how the mayor holds on to that power.
And Austin,
and Paul, just two statistics for you.
Sure.
This actually just came out. The Daily Line did a great report on this. I believe McDumpke from ProPublica was also involved. From 2011 to 2018, the mayor of Chicago sponsored more citywide ordinances than all 50 aldermen combined.
Wow.
These are not legislators. They're local ombudsmen. And of course, in that sort of vacuum, the mayor is able to take up all the air in the room when it comes to citywide legislation. The second statistic, when we started writing the book, in the last 28 years, 28 aldermen were initially seated by appointment, as Ed said. So how can you expect an independent legislature when so many are appointed by the executive that they're supposed to be, you know, sort of adversarial with?
It's a good point. And it leads to power and corruption. And Austin, I was going to come to you on this. I mean, talk a little bit about how Chicago polices itself and as compared to how oversight happens in a whole bunch of other cities that you study. Because obviously when, you know, what do they say? Power corrupt, blah, 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 power corrupts absolutely, absolute power corrupts, you know the phrase.
Yes.
You know, how do we end up with that here? And, of course, part of the statistics you're giving are that reason. When you do have efforts like former Governor Pat Quinn, who tries to get a term limits referendum on there, boom, the mayor's already filled up the three-limit referendum limit, you know, with stuff like plastic straws to make sure that the real stuff like term – well, I mean, plastic straws are an important issue. I don't mean to put that down. But issues like term limits and stuff are never going to make it on. It, to me, it just all smells of corruption, whatever. So talk about oversight here versus elsewhere, Austin.
Sure. We can definitely talk about oversight, and then we should come back to that question of voter approval, because that we're such a big outlier on that. So in terms of oversight, that chapter, we knew we had to do a chapter on corruption because it is often such a red herring in Chicago politics. We say that there's a very simple political theory that reigns in Chicago, and it's three steps. One, everybody's corrupt. Two, there's nothing that can be done about it. And three, throw up your hands. And we don't find that to be a too productive a discussion when, you know, the problems that the city has are man-made and there are man-made solutions. So the quote we open the chapter with is by Studs Terkel, and it is a quote that says, Chicago is not the most corrupt American city, it is the most theatrically corrupt American city. Now, what does that mean? It's actually borne out in the data. We think of Chicago as a huge outlier in corruption. But when you actually look at per capita corruption figures by federal judicial district, which is how those things are measured, over the last 10 years, Chicago is actually fifth. We have other cities like Philadelphia. I could look back in the book. Philadelphia is one of them. I believe Houston is another, mm-hmm. that have higher per capita corruption overall than Chicago does. So that actually is in line with some of the more recent reforms we have. Our Inspector General's office of Joe Ferguson actually, when you compare it across other cities, is pretty empowered and is pretty modernized in terms of a modern watchdog body. Here's where we are a huge outlier: aldermen going to prison. And why is that? It's because of governance, because it's because of the administrative bottleneck powers they have to grant permits to every Tom, Dick, and Harry in their ward who wants to do anything, needs to rely on their aldermen to do so. So it's not surprising that those aldermen end up caught, you know, on a wire or shaking down a Burger King franchise owner, as Ed Burke allegedly did. That's not surprising given our governance structure. So really, in the book, we say there's one simple change you could probably we suggest that you could make to the Inspector General's office to make it a little bit more powerful, and that is consolidate the offices. Chicago has a bunch of different Inspector Generals for different agencies. So there's a Chicago Public Schools Inspector General, there is a CTA Inspector General, there is a Park District Inspector General, there is a City Inspector General. In New York City, all of those are consolidated into one office called the Department of Investigations. And that really aligns with the way that the power is distributed in Chicago. The mayor appoints the boards of all of those agencies, so the oversight agency should also be centralized because that's how the power works in Chicago. That's one simple change we could make, but the biggest change would be to change those responsibilities of aldermen. That would be clean up city government more than any other reform you could make.
And, you know, I find it really interesting that as we live through this mayoral election, so many of the candidates talked about ending, and what you're describing, Austin, is aldermanic prerogative. That's what they refer to it as. Yes, we got to get rid of it. We got to get rid of it. Except in order to get rid of it, it's the aldermen who have to vote to get rid of it, and that's never going to happen. So, Ed, let me ask you, some of the other approaches or questions related to this and how we get it under control is, well, the size of city council. I mean, Bill Daley ran on a platform of, you know, let's lower that number from 50 aldermen to 15. Others have said, let's bring it down to 25. It's always been an issue for me because I thought, you know, right now at 50 aldermen, the thought is that's too many and larger cities like L.A. have fewer. But if you give fewer aldermen more constituents, to me, that will consolidate their power, Ed, not diminish it.
Well, the key is, do they have power or not? Right now, the aldermen don't have the power, the type of power, the nature of power that the city needs for intelligent, deliberative democracy. They're not looking at the big issues that affect the whole city. But you take other cities where they have a larger number of constituents per councilman. They can't attend to every little thing. They're not subject to corruption. They look at the big city issues, they have robust committees in the city council, and they study the issues so they make better decisions. So, yes, they should have more power. The mayor should have less power, but it should be intelligent power, power that is wielded for the city and the citizens' benefit and not for parochial interests for themselves and the special interest in their wards.
Austin, one of the things that I think troubles many people is when a mayor steps in and does some of the things Mayor Daley did, Mayor Richard M. Daley, like closing Meg's Field in the middle of night, claiming it's for national security, selling off the parking meters in a huge fund that got spent within a couple of years. I remember interviewing him in his final days, and I said, you know, you sold this off and the money's almost gone. And he goes, well, it was meant to be rainy day money, and guess what? It's raining. That was his answer to that. You know, selling off the Skyway, just all of the Grant Park garage. You can go on and on. But the reason I mention all of that is, and let me add, I'm going to even add the pension into that, because the point is we all wake up now, and whether you like what he did or like the pension situation that we're in, and you guys call the pension situation a pension apocalypse, there's nothing that can be done about it right now. I mean, the deals are made. What's done seems to be done. So it's all about just looking forward, right?
So it's definitely about looking forward, but we also need to look at the structural factors that got us to this point, especially in regards to finances. So we looked at what we called fiscal firewalls across all the largest 15 cities. There's three of them. One is an independent elected controller, so someone who has real budgetary give and take with the mayor's office, is doing independent projections, is putting out its own numbers. The second one was voter approval for tax hikes and new debt. So you can't just, you know, hike those things willy-nilly. You need to go to voters and ask them if we should borrow, you know, $10 billion for pensions, as Rahm Emanuel had suggested. And finally, a robust city council that participates in the budget-making process. Of the 15 largest cities, Chicago was the only one that lacked all three. So you can't be surprised when we lack those things that we've had profligate spending and borrowing. The political incentive has been to make everything free by paying for it tomorrow. And our governance structure has really, really encouraged that. We just talked about elected officials, by the way. And you're right. A lot of mayoral candidates had talked about eliminating aldermanic privilege, and that is a great debate to have, even though, you know, it took the largest fish on city council being under federal investigation for that to happen. But that is a great conversation and one that we very much encourage in our book. But why do we stop at that? Why don't we talk about the other elected city officials in our city? When you look at the three citywide positions, they are the mayor, who holds all the power, the city treasurer, who I think you could ask 100 Chicagoans what the city treasurer does and they wouldn't know.
Right.
99 of them wouldn't know. And the same thing for the city clerk. Why do we have those two offices with absolutely no power when we could copy cities like Houston, New York, and Los Angeles and have an elected independent city controller or manager? Or we could act like Los Angeles and have an elected city attorney to be an independent check on the mayor instead of the mayor wielding complete control over the law department. So we need to have the point of the book is to raise these much broader governance questions than simply just, you know, the number of aldermen or their responsibilities. It's about the entire structure of city government.
And Ed, you guys argue in the book for something we need, which a lot of people probably think we have, which is a city charter. And it turns out, I think it's us in Indianapolis are the only cities among the top 15 that don't have one. So if we don't have a city charter, what do we have?
We have a combination of the Illinois Municipal Code, and we have the compilation of ordinances in the city of Chicago. And all of those either come from a legislative body, the city council, or from the state legislature. But they're not voter approved, and they're not really thought out. The National Civic League has a manual for charter creation and revision, and it tells you how to go about having a citizen-based, constitutional city charter that everyone votes on. And that's how cities reform.
You know, Austin, one of the things you guys argue for in the book to address the pension apocalypse, as you call it, is a new dedicated property tax that would only go for pensions. And actually, I think one of the mayoral candidates talked about that as well. But, you know, I guess I have two questions about that. Number one, I don't know what your property taxes are in the city, but adding on one more property tax, and I think people almost resent sometimes a pension tax because they feel like we're in this situation and it's not my fault and I'm paying for it. So, you know, the taxes are already through the roof with Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas reporting, if you thought it was bad first session, wait till you get your next bill in August. It may be going up 30%, she says. And then the other fear is, even if we did do that, and even if your guy's suggestion is, well, let's have this tax, but no, really, when we get that pension paid down, it goes away. I think of a tollway tax, tolls, which were only supposed to pay, of course, until the tollway was paid for. And all of a sudden, it's amazing how none of those tolls ever go away.
Paul, it's Ed. You mind if I answer that question?
Go for it.
And then we'll turn to Austin.
Sure.
I want to clarify, we don't specify that there be a dedicated property tax to pay down the pensions. We do specify that we need to pay the pensions down sooner than the current amortization schedules, and probably should have some kind of a dedicated tax to do that. But more important than that,
So what you're saying is, because I know I pulled, I mean, I did read your book, as you know. So what you're saying is, yes, you talk about a new dedicated tax, but it's not necessarily a property tax.
Not necessarily a property tax, but even before you do that, earlier in this podcast, you asked how we got into this. And I got into it through the pension portal. I'd been working on the city's pension problem for 4 years. And I got the example of San Diego. And they thought they had a pension crisis when their total pension debt reached $1 billion. Chicago's is currently $43 billion. And at the time in San Diego, they indicted five of their pension officials. So they went on a resolution program. They froze all the pensionable compensation in the whole city until the pensions or funding was caught up. Other municipalities have gone to defined contribution plans, or they have their employees on Social Security. So what's really needed before there's even a tax, you have to balance the interest of the taxpayers and the pensioners and those active participants in the pensions. And part of that balance is you've got to end defined contribution plans in the city once and for all and permanently. Can't appear again. You have to consider compensation freezes for people that are active right now, and the city has to really embrace fiscal discipline. Elsewhere in the book, we show that compensation or total expenditures for the two largest departments for the city, fire and police, are bloated by at least $650 million a year. So the first thing you got to do is you've got to give taxpayers, whatever tax they pay, a reason to want to pay the tax and stay in the city instead of leaving. And that means real reform of not only the plans themselves, but the fiscal structure in the city.
Austin, I have a question for you, but do you want to chime in on what Ed said first?
No, I totally agree. And I think there's another, I mean, I would personally applaud outgoing Mayor Rahm Emanuel on the fact that he said Illinois should have a constitutional amendment to allow changes to things like 3% compounding benefit increases throughout life for retirees. That would do an enormous amount. But yeah, again, we're somewhat agnostic on the way that the city decides to infuse to pay for pensions earlier instead of dumping this burden on the young and unborn. But the problem is we do not have a deliberative legislative body that can even has the capacity, interest, or power to consider such things. That agenda is driven completely by the mayor, and that's how we got into this mess in the first place.
So we have this financial issue that, of course, consumes everybody who has to pay taxes and live in the city. But, Austin, I wanted to come to you with the other very prevalent topic that got discussed all through, certainly, the mayor's race, and will continue on, and that's the whole crime and violence situation. One of the things you guys write about in the book is that while we hear about crime statistics all the time, and Superintendent Eddie Johnson makes his way onto, certainly, our WGN morning show every month, always with seemingly good news, which is murders are down, your point is, Austin, that crime statistics, they're just a piece of the puzzle.
Absolutely. They're just a piece of the puzzle. And, Paul, you probably know, you might know this better than any other person in Chicago media, but the reputation of the Los Angeles Police Department post-Rodney King was every bit as bad as, if not worse, than the Chicago Police Department.
That's why they bought Bill Bratton.
Would you agree?
Yeah, they bought Bill Bratton, and that's why.
Yeah, exactly. So, and we talked to police reform experts in, and as you know, I mean, the real, if we want to look at one statistic that really explains has a lot of explanatory power when it comes to Chicago crime, is the clearance rate. You're having people, you know, shooters 20% of the time not being cleared, not being found, not being charged. And that speaks to a complete breakdown of trust between policing and the communities they police. And if you talk to policing experts in Los Angeles as to how they turn this around, remember that Los Angeles has, I believe, at last count, around a fifth of the homicide rate of Chicago. And by many accounts, by all accounts, their policing reputation has increased exponentially since post-Rodney King. So how did they do that? Two key reforms there. One, independent police commission that chooses the police commissioner. The mayor appoints that commission, but that commission is free to choose who they would like to run the police department, and the police department reports to that commission, not to the mayor. Whereas in Chicago, you had Rahm Emanuel, for instance, pick Eddie Johnson over the heads of everyone, and the city council suspended the rules for a day to allow him to do that.
Right.
That would never happen in a place like Los Angeles, and it insulates the police department from the types of, you know, power politics that we see in big cities. When you separate it with a commission. Here's the second change. All disciplinary procedures are instantiated, are written in state law. They are not collectively bargained over. So in California, you have a Peace Officers Bill of Rights. It outlines the disciplinary procedures for police. It outlines sort of what the interview process is like after a police-involved shooting, things like this. Versus Chicago, where you have over decades mayors bargaining with the president of the FOP, Fraternal Order of Police, the rank and file police union, over things like, hey, you guys won't get as big of raises as you wanted, but you get 24 hours of cool-off time after there's a shooting. Those types of bargains and deals should never happen when it comes to public safety. And the fact that Chicago won a lot, and even if you look at the federal consent decree, those things are still beneath some of the collective bargaining agreements in the police force. Even the federal government can't overcome that. So those are the two big changes we look at in terms of policing in Chicago and how to improve that.
And Ed, it almost seems to add insult to injury when, of course, we just lived through the Laquan McDonald killing and the Jason Van Dyke trial. And, you know, listen, there are a lot of kudos to the system for putting Jason Van Dyke on trial. And that's not an anti-police comment at all. I mean, it's just something happened and the system needs to work and do its thing. And he was found guilty of second degree murder and I think 17 charges of assaulted battery and stuff. And I'm just curious. Then, of course, the sentence comes down and he gets less than 7 years, which some stand behind and say that's what he should get. Then you had the three officers who were accused of somehow kind of changing things to cover things up for him, all found not guilty by a judge. I'm not saying those are wrong sentences or wrong verdicts or determinations, Ed, but I am sort of asking with the issues people have in the city of community police relations, those kinds of sentences and verdicts don't seem to help the appearance or to enhance the relationship over time, even if they are correct.
They certainly don't. But we the point of that we make and that Austin just made, if we had a more rational and a more police governance structure, including a police commission, including an independently elected city attorney, we would never have gotten to this point. They would have had professional management of outlier patrolmen like Jason Van Dyke, He probably never would have had an opportunity to shoot Laquan McDonald if it had been in Los Angeles under the current regime in Los Angeles. So you gotta back up. You can't bring Laquan McDonald back to life, and our book doesn't address the judiciary and how the judge made his ruling. But with more professional and civilian oversight of police, the conditions would prevent something like that.
And look at the electoral consequences of that massive tragedy post-Laquan. Anita Alvarez, Cook County State's attorney, lost her job.
Right.
But there were no consequences for the city law department, which absolutely represented the mayor's interest 100% in how that was rolled out and covered up.
Well, there are some who believe the mayor chose not to run for re-election, at least in part because of that. So maybe there are some consequences for
that. There are for one office, and it takes a massive tragedy such as that to even have that person consider not wanting to run a tough re-election where he might have a chance of not winning. So that's what we talk about sort of people are scared to let Chicagoans vote on these things because when they are allowed to, things like Anita Alvarez being ousted from office happen. But that should also happen, at the local level with council members rather than, you know, aldermen controlling every nook and cranny of the ward. It should happen with an elected city attorney. It should happen with an elected comptroller who is responsible for the finances. And it should happen, most importantly, with voter approval of the type of governance that we have through a city charter.
And the final topic, before we wrap, I'll come back to you, schools and education being the topic. Yeah, there's a great quote I loved in your book where you talk about our schools here in Chicago are a twisted mess of fiscal, demographic, and sociopolitical problems. Some are self-inflicted. It's not a funny phrase, but I just love the way it's phrased. And you talk about the fact that very few of these other big cities you looked at have appointed school boards. We do. In fact, only four of the top 20, as you point out. And that was one of the issues in the mayor's race as well, which is who would appoint, who would elect, who would have a hybrid. But I have this theory. I get the argument behind an elected school board, let the people have a voice. But I also have this feeling, Ed, that if you let people vote for school board officials, they'll do it the same way they vote for judges, which is they don't really know very much. They look for the Irish name, or they look for the, you know, some affiliate, who's a woman, gender, race, you pick it, religion. They try and find the names that match up with their world. Now, maybe that's their choice, and that's what they can do. But isn't the argument for at least a partially appointed school board that you've got some kind of quality control, admittedly biased quality control, coming up? I'm wondering if there's another alternative, which is somehow appointments but subject to city council or an outside board's affirmation, something. But I think if you just leave elected school board in people's hands, maybe I'm not giving it enough credit to think they'll actually do their proper homework and vote wisely. What do you think, Ed?
Paul, I hate to be mildly critical of you, but with all due respect, just about every change and reform we talk about in the book, people have a counter argument, something like yours, like, I think that this could happen or this could happen. What I ask you to do is what we did. Call all those other big cities and big school districts that elect their school board and ask them how it's working out for them. And you'll find that many of the fears that people have of an elected school board are overblown. And when they find out what goes on in Chicago, they have a heightened fear of an appointed school board. And I want to make one other point about the elected school board. Not only is an elected school board better for the schools, it's better for the city. The mayor of Chicago lost a lot of political capital when he closed 50 schools and he made his first act when he was first elected, lengthening the school day and lengthening the school year without consulting the union. He had a strike. He did a lot of things, quote, for the schools because he could, and it paralyzed his political capital, and that's why he had to go into runoff the second time he ran. And that certainly was the ire of the teachers, and the teachers union was perhaps as much of a factor in his deciding not to run as the Laquan McDonald or fiscal or pension or other issues. So
And by the way, I'm good with what you said. Otherwise, we would have completely edited you out of this podcast. So that's my new Chicago way. But we're not going to have to do that, fortunately.
Okay.
Austin, I do want to get kind of a final word from each of you guys for folks who have been listening to us and I'm sure fascinated by all you're saying. And they will obviously want to pick up a copy of the new Chicago Way, Lessons from Big Cities. I found it actually kind of there's lots of statistics, I will tell you. It's so full of research, but it really is kind of an easy read. And that's so important. It doesn't read like a textbook or anything like that. It's a very comfortable read, published by Southern Illinois University Press in Carbondale. So I'll come to Austin. I'll end with you, Ed, which is when people read this book, and if they're tired about how things are, but they feel a little depressed, like nothing's ever going to change, what message, Austin, do we take from the new Chicago Way to give us hope in the near future or the long-term future?
Yeah. So first, Chicago is an outlier in its problems. We have very big problems, and there's no, I think people intuitively understand that, but maybe they don't know the degree to which we are an outlier. Second, those problems are man-made, and they happen because of decisions within a structure that is antiquated and far behind that of other major American cities. And reforming that is not, does not need to be in the image of a libertarian utopia. It can be in the image of strongly democratic, strongly union towns, such as Los Angeles. And at the end of the day, we really want people to understand the C word, charter. People do not understand. When we say the word charter, people think it means charter schools, when in fact it's the city constitution. It is the most important single reform the city could make in changing its future as a voter-approved city charter.
Ed, what's your word of hope?
My word of hope, if you don't mind, I'll just quote a little bit from the book, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
Okay.
I did.
Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend upon the ideas that are lying around. That, I believe, is our basic function, to develop alternatives to existing policies to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes the politically inevitable. So that's why this book was written.
And that's why people ought to check out the book. And that's why I wanted to give you guys the entire podcast today, because the issues are important. We're living through a mayoral election now, which I don't know what's going to happen, in the city. But I do know that we will be under a new administration. Things are changing. They don't change very often in this city, but we will be under a change. And so I think the lessons that you provide from other big cities, that's the subtitle of your book, by the way, becomes important for us to look ahead. And who knows, maybe it'll inspire some young people who are listening in to run for office, run for alderman, try and make a difference, get some of these changes made. The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities is the name of the book. The co-authors are Ed Bachrach and Austin Berg. It is published by Southern Illinois University Press in Carbondale. I encourage you to get a copy of it, because you know what, even though this was maybe one of the longer interviews you guys have done on this book without commercial interruption, which is why I enjoy doing this, but we didn't even begin to cover so many of the points you make in the book, and it's a great read, and I hope people will check that out. And I thank you guys very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Paul.
All right, the New Chicago Way. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week. Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more Insider Scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.